This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasothi. Your kidney works hard to clear excess salts from what you have digested. But when the salts build up in your kidney, so does the trouble. These salts can harden into stones as big as a ping pong ball and can cause you excruciating pain. Some men will tell you it's almost like, you know, birth women experience when, you know, they give birth. But, you know, I have my doubts about that because what would, you know, most men know about what we go through during childbirth. But how can you prevent these urinary stones, and how do you remove them? We learn more from Dr. Badrul Hisham Bahazur, who's a consultant urologist from Sunway Medical Center. Welcome to the show, Dr. Badrul. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you.
You know, how does one really feel when there's a stone, Dr. Badrul?
Well, you'd be surprised to know that most patients may not know that they actually have a stone in the kidney. Stones are generally formed in the kidney. Mm-hmm. And when only the stones moved from the kidney into the tube that connect the kidney to the bladder, called the ureter, and when the stone is jammed there, then only the patient will have symptoms. And the symptom would be severe excruciating pain. It's described as a pain which varies in intensity. It goes waxes and wanes. The patient cannot do anything to reduce the pain, no matter what he does, no matter what position he takes. The only thing that can reduce the pain is going to emergency and get a jab of a painkiller. So pain is the cardinal symptom of somebody who's got a stone which is jammed in the ureter. So it's termed as ureteric colic.
Okay. Just before I come to my next question, our phone lines are open if you'd like to call and ask Dr. Badrul a question. It's 03-77-109000. You can tweet us at BFM Radio, or you can text 016-201-9000. But you know what? Just give us a call if you feel like. 03-77-109000. Are there even early signs, Dr. Badrul, to tell you that there could be a stone in the kidney before, you know, the excruciating pain sets upon?
Well, not many, I guess. Some patients describe as having very vague discomfort of pain at the back, which can also be a symptoms of other things like, you know, a backache after very physical activities.
Mm-hmm.
Some patients may found to have blood in their urine when they go and see their doctor. Non-visible blood, you know, microscopic blood.
And that you would only pick up if you happen to see the doctor.
Yeah,
because otherwise you won't be able
otherwise
to see it.
Otherwise, you'll be walking around in the public in outside there, you know, not knowing that you actually have one.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Okay. And how big are these stones? Because ping pong balls are huge.
Yeah.
In comparison to the urethra.
Yeah.
How does it even grow that big?
Well, the stones can be as small as sandy fragments, you know, a millimeter in size or even smaller. Or as big as a tennis ball, you know, not a ping pong ball, a tennis ball. Yeah, yeah.
That's massive.
Yes.
How big is your kidney?
Well, that's the thing. You know, we call it urinary stones, and so the stones may not just be found in the kidney. It can also be found in the bladder, mm-hmm. in the ureter, and a passage that goes through the penis. Called the urethra.
Okay.
So they can grow as big as tennis ball, 5 centimeters, 7 centimeters in diameter. In the kidney, they branch out.
They're all made in the kidney.
They are all made in the kidney initially. Whereas in the bladder, because the bladder, you know, the bladder can expand to about 400 to 600 mils in capacity. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine a stone which occupies a spherical cavity of that size. It can be as big as 7-8 centimeters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So it really depends. What about the gallbladder? Can stones get into that area?
Well, yeah, interestingly, I've always been asked about these questions about stones in the gallbladder. It's actually a completely different system. What we deal would be stones which develop in the urinary system, mm-hmm. whereas gallstones are stones which actually develop in the gastrointestinal system.
Right.
So, yeah, so it's a separate thing, separate process, separate stone composition, separate, you know, physiology, pathology, to explain why the stones get there. Yeah.
So what is the stone composition that comes through the urinary tract?
Majority, more than 85% of urinary stones are from calcium.
Mm-hmm.
So majority are calcium oxalate or calcium phosphate. The other 15% are stone due to infections. They are called struvite or magnesium ammonium phosphate stones. There's another stones which is formed from uric acid, whether pure uric acid or a mixture of calcium and uric acid, called calcium urate stones. And finally, there's a stone called cysteine stones, which are metabolic stones due to an inherited condition. So patients who've got this condition would have had this problem ever since they were very young.
Okay, but does it make a difference what the composition of the stone is when it comes to management?
Well, in a way, there is, because these stones actually formed in different kind of environment. For instance, with uric acid stones and cysteine stones, they are formed within an acidic environment in the urine. So if we were to test the urine pH is actually quite low. They are normally less than 5.5. Whereas in magnesium, ammonium phosphate or infection stones, they are formed due to infection. And the urine pH is normally a bit higher, around 7 to 8. Whereas calcium oxalate stone, which is the commonest one, have the tendency to be formed in neutral pH. So the process at which the stone came about can be different.
Okay, but does it depend, or does that decide how you manage the stone?
To a certain extent, for instance, if you can manipulate the pH, maybe the stone can be dissolved.
Of the surrounding?
Yeah, the surrounding pH. So a patient can modify their diet or take medications in order to increase the pH to make it less acidic, in the case if they've got uric acid stones. Mm-hmm. That may help in the long run, but provided that the stones are of a certain size and not too big.
How would you know the pH of a stone?
You don't know actually the pH. You know the pH of the urine we test.
Right,
yeah, not
okay.
the stone.
Not the stone. And that tells you what sort of stone,
yes,
roughly.
Yeah, roughly.
And then the management of it.
Yeah.
But besides the pain, how else would a stone affect us?
Well, the other presentation that the patient may have would be if the stone has formed complications. If they are jammed in the tube, in the ureter, they can cause blockage. Mm-hmm. So the kidney will not be able to function in a correct manner. So it will be detected in the blood results. The patient may get an infection because the urine, which is obstructed, can get infected with bacteria. And infection can further become much more complicated, going into the blood, causing sepsis and causing pus formation, for instance, around the kidney.
So can you die from a stone?
You can. It has happened before, especially in patients who's got other medical illnesses, mm-hmm. Such as diabetes, which is poorly controlled. So they come in with multiple issues, which is actually probably caused initially by the stones becoming obstructed.
Okay, yeah. But can other conditions exacerbate the formation of stones?
There are, yes. There are. I mentioned earlier about the genetic conditions of cystinuria that can actually cause someone to have recurrent stone. Conditions such as gout, where a patient has very high level of uric acid in their blood, so they tend to have recurrent uric acid stone. Conditions like two conditions in the kidney called medullary sponge kidney or nephrocalcinosis, where there's a lot of calcium deposits all around the kidney. And that, again, can predispose a patient to develop calcium type of stones.
But what about the ordinary person who picks up who happens to get a stone in the urinary system?
Yeah, it's probably a combination of genetic and environment and probably lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So we don't really know what sort of genetic factors that they have. Environment, we know that people living in tropical temperate climate tends to get more risk of having kidney stones, and lifestyle, obesity, change in diet, eating more of this animal protein can make someone prone to get kidney stones.
So I suppose the main component would be dehydration because of tropical climate. Is that why?
Yes.
So does that mean if you flood your system with water, you'll be all right? Flood meaning stick to the 2 or 3 liters of water a day?
Yeah. I guess to answer that question, it's probably good to know about how actually the stones came about, how the stone actually is, it's formed in the kidney. So it's all started with, well, there are many theories to describe this. One of them is this supersaturation theories whereby we think the urine becomes supersaturated with this crystal, with these ions, you know, whether it's uric acid, calcium, oxalates. There are too much of them in the urine. And that occurs as a result probably because of lack of water, for instance. And because of that, crystals are being formed in the urine. Mm-hmm. And the crystals slowly aggregate, and slowly over time they increase in size, and they form deposits within the kidney. And again, this process gets repeated all over again, and until eventually the stones become bigger and bigger. So if you were to say, drink lots of water, you can prevent this process from happening. You know, you can probably help to prevent, first of all, the urine from being supersaturated with all these crystals. And if these crystals were to be formed, the amount of urine that's being produced, lots of urine can help to wash out the crystals.
Mm-hmm. But depending on the size as well, isn't it?
Yes, well, crystals are still within the, you know, the size where it can just be flushed out easily. Right. Okay. Yeah.
And it seems like men seem to be more prone to urinary stones. Is there a reason for that?
No specific reasons, I guess. Statistically speaking, that's probably true, say, 10 to 20 years ago. But there are recent reports that's showing that the ratio between men and women in terms of their risk of having stones has actually reduced. It's close to 1-to-1 now, actually.
Okay, so 50-50.
Yeah. Almost 50-50,
wow.
Yeah.
Mm. And what about the women? What contributes towards their stone?
It's the same reason as men, yeah.
For women, even with, if you talk about gout, right, high uric acid levels, you still find men a little bit more prone to gout than women. So is there anything else that would contribute towards urinary stones in women?
Women are a little bit more prone to get infection, urinary tract infections.
Yes.
And if they have persistent infection by a certain type of bacteria, bacteria known as Proteus and Klebsiella, and this can actually produce a special type of enzymes which can break down the ammonia, the urea in the urine to form more ammonia. And as a result, a patient can get infection stone called struvite stones. We tend to see this a lot more in women as compared to men.
Okay, so the different type of stone then is what's different. Okay, we're discussing the urinary stones, and we're going to come to the surgical management of this. I mean, is surgery really required in managing urinary stones, and to what extent? When do urologists decide that, you know, surgery is indeed an option? Our phone lines are open. Guys, women, now it's 50-50. Call us with your question. It's 0377109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 0162019000. Good afternoon. Welcome to the show. If you have just joined us, I'm Mira Sivasodhi, and with me, Dr. Badrul Hisham Bahazur, who's a consultant urologist from Sanwi Medical Center. We're discussing surgical management of urinary stones. Dr. Badrul, the pain strikes at different places with different intensity when a stone is actually passing through. Why is that?
Yes, it depends on the degree of distension that is caused by the stone being jammed or impacted at the site where it wasn't able to move anymore. Okay, so if the stone is impacted at the upper part of the kidney tube, then the pain tends to be occurring much higher at the back. Whereas if the stone is obstructed at the lower part of the ureter or the kidney tube, the pain can be found a little bit lower, and sometimes it can radiate to the groin, or in men to the tip of the penis, sometimes to the testes. In women, they may complain pain radiating to the labia. So it's not an accurate sign. Sometimes the stone can be anywhere, and the pain can just be falsely localized around the abdomen.
So how do you diagnose it?
Well, you need to. To get the diagnosis, actually, you need to get an imaging, because there's no way of telling whether a patient has got a stone or not just by simply examining the abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So a patient would present, history would be taken, examination would be done. You know, we normally check the urine to make sure that there's no infection, for instance. I'll check the blood and see how well the kidney is functioning. But to make the diagnosis of urinary stones and a type of imaging needs to be decided to be done.
Okay. So, yeah. I mean, the patient usually comes to you with excruciating pain.
Yeah.
Do you get the pain under control first before you progress?
Obviously.
How does that make a difference?
Oh, yeah, obviously. I mean, you know, you won't be able to proceed, you know, then
even
just saying...
touching the abdomen.
Yeah. So, a patient would immediately get an injection of a strong painkiller. Usually, we tend to give non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs because it's been proven that it's quite good in reducing the pain. Yeah. Once we get the pain under control, then we can go then and do all these investigations.
Okay. And, you know, we always use pain as an indicator. Now, I'm just going to give you an example of a case study where a person actually, you know, had this excruciating pain, went to accident and emergency and was told that he most probably has a stone, right? And after which doctor says, we need to do surgery. Of course, after the imaging, there was a stone confirmed, but surgery was only done the next day. But by evening, the pain had subsided. What does that mean? When the pain goes down, does that mean that the stone has passed out? What does that really mean? Or the stone is not moving? What does it mean?
Yeah. Well, when the diagnosis is made, you only have a snapshot of what happened when the image was taken.
Mm-hmm.
So when the image was taken, supposedly a stone has been found stuck in the tube somewhere along, whether it was the upper part or lower part. So we have information as to the site and the size of the stone, and also what sort of problems has it done to the urinary systems of the affected site, or to how bad the kidney is swollen, for instance. The pain is to do with the stretching of the kidney, you know? And it occurs more in the first couple of hours when the stone is impacted at the site. But after a while, due to, you know, physiological response of our kidney starts to reduce the amount of urine being produced in the affected kidney. So as a result, the amount of stretching become less and less.
Mm-hmm.
So the pain slowly will ease off and disappear, commonly around a day after the initial presentation.
Okay, and very often urologists adopt this wait and see kind of an attitude, right?
Yeah.
Let's wait and see whether the stone comes out, but how long do you wait? And,
yeah.
And what do you take into consideration before you decide, okay, we'll wait and see for this patient, failing which we'll go to surgery, or, you know, no, this patient needs surgery now. How do you decide that?
Yeah. Well, basically what we are talking here is about stone which is in the ureter. So we will see as to how bad the stone is causing the symptoms, how bad would be the pain would be. And then the size of the stone, the site of the stone, whether it's in the upper part or the lower part, any complications such as infection or, you know, abnormal kidney function, for instance, any other medical issues that the patient has, such as diabetes or pre-existing kidney condition, for instance. So we have to take all this into an account before we can say the patient can be safely managed in a watch and waiting manner,
okay,
or they need to go straight for surgery. Obviously, if there's evidence of infection or abnormally functioning kidney, I think we need to remove the stones or even disimpact the stones by putting a stent immediately.
But waiting and watching could expose the patient to developing an infection as well.
Yes, the risk is there. It could happen. But in a patient who's well, who's healthy, the risk of that happening would probably be much less. And the patient would need to be advised that if they feel unwell, if they start getting fever or if the pain starts to happen again, they need to come back to the hospitals immediately. And you know, you could probably at the time advise the patient that the period of conservative management is, you know, is probably over. Mm-hmm. It's probably time to remove the stone now.
Okay.
So stone, I just mentioned about size, actually. So we know stones which are less than 5 millimeter in size has about 50% chance of passing out spontaneously. Smaller stones will have a better chance. Bigger stones will have lesser chance.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, we wait about 4 weeks to 6 weeks to see whether they can come out or not.
That's a long time.
Yeah. So about, you know, day 40. Again, depending on the size. And if the student has not passed out at all after 40 days, the patient is usually advised that they will need a procedure to get the stones removed.
All right. We have Dr. Badrul Hisham Bahazur, consultant urologist from Sunway Medical Center, in the studio with us, answering your questions on urinary stones. We're going to move on to surgical management of urinary stones. If you have a question for him, give us a call. The phone lines are open. It's 03-77-109-000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 016-201. 9,000. Now, I love it when I ask doctors these questions, you know. You always hear of, you know, I took radish juice and it worked. The stone came out. I took grapefruit and it helped. What do you think of all of that? Does that really work?
I don't really know. There are no good scientific evidence to support the use of all these products. But I guess if they are naturally occurring compounds, there's no harm in trying them out. Scientifically, I can suggest certain medications in order to help the stone to pass out spontaneously by itself. There are medications which are designed to relax the area around the stone so that the tube can open up a bit more. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's actually a muscular tube, so
to help it to
relax and pass out. Actually, probably the most effective and cheapest way would just be to drink a lot more water, and produce more urine. You know, you want to be producing urine in the area of 2.5 liters of urine per day. You know, that means you need to be peeing a lot in order to flush out these stones.
Yeah, okay, yeah. But does it work most of the time?
Yeah, well, like I said, small stones have better chance than bigger stones. And obviously, stones located in the lower part of the kidney tube have better chance of coming out than the stones which are located in the upper part.
And these stones tend to be recurring for people who have had stone issues in the urinary tract. Do we know why?
Well, there are conditions, like I mentioned before, medical conditions, for instance, high uric acid in gout. So they tend to have this problem chronically and they can form more uric acid stones again in the future. But there are other conditions like calcium oxalate stone where we don't really know why they are forming recurringly in these patients.
Okay.
Yeah.
As Arizuddin is asking, at exactly which part of the abdomen would you feel pain, the front area or back? And of course, once again, his doctor advised him to take cranberry juice for kidney infection. Is that all right? There you go, doctor.
Okay. All right. Oh, well, the first question is about the location of the pain.
Yes.
It can mean that if it's at the back, it could mean that the stone is actually located in the upper part of the urinary tract. If it's at the front, towards the lower part, it could mean that the stone is now situated at the lower part of the urinary tract. But this is not
cast in stone.
Yeah, cast in stone. Okay. It could be anywhere. And then
with cranberry and
juice,
kidney infection.
Yeah, there are some research papers which look into using cranberry juice. I guess it's one of those which can it's been used to prevent or to treat even urinary tract infection. It provides some citrate in the urine. Citrate is good to prevent all this crystal aggregation. I suppose if someone still doesn't have a stone or has been treated for a stone, in order to prevent future stone formation, it's probably good to take some additional citrate, so that there will be more of this in the urine.
So they don't aggregate.
Yeah.
It's basically what you don't want, isn't it?
Yeah.
Robert, how are you? Your question?
Fine. Good afternoon, doctor.
Good afternoon.
Doctor, I understand about 40 years ago, we can blast kidney stone by using a machine known as lithotripsy, is it?
Okay. You want to know whether that still exists or...
Does it exist or is it?
Okay. Thank you very much, Robert.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Yes. Thank you, Robert. Yes, the machine still exists and newer machines are being created every few years, actually. And the machines are widely available all around Malaysia in many public and private hospitals. The machines are called shockwave lithotripter, which, mistakenly called by a lot of people as laser. Actually, there is no laser involved at all within the machine. High energy shockwave is being focused onto the stones, where the stones are located, and this will cause fragmentation. The stone will be broken down into smaller pieces, and the fragments need to come out of the kidney on its own. So the patient still needs to do what he needs to do, which is drink lots of water to flush all the fragments out. Yeah, it's still being practiced in many hospitals. The treatment, actually, it's quite easy. There is no general anesthetic usually involved. It can be done just by a simple sedation or just painkillers. Takes about 45 to 1 hour. And shocks are delivered to the stone to fragment it from low energy to high energy.
So it's not invasive?
It's not invasive. It's a day case. Patient doesn't need to stay in hospital at all. They can just have it done and go home immediately.
Are there risks involved? When you say blast, I'm thinking of fragments going all over the place. can that actually be a downside to all of that?
Yeah, well, it's highly technical, actually. You want to be able to focus the shockwave to the right area, obviously,
yes,
to the stone and not to other places. And that greatly affects the rate of stone clearance afterwards. You know, you may have an unsuccessful attempt of breaking the stones if you have been blasting the wrong part. And because of that, sometimes it's quite difficult to be able to target the area accurately. A patient who's on medications to dilute their blood, you know, who's taking anticoagulation or aspirin.
Stroke patients, for instance.
They might not be a patient who is suitable for this because it can cause quite a bit of bleeding in the kidney.
Okay, yeah. All right then. We may just come back after a quick news update. If you have a question for Dr. Baharul Mahazur, who is a consultant urologist from Sunway Medical Center, we're discussing surgical management of urinary stones. The number to call us is 03-7710-9000. Tweet BFM Radio or text 016-201-9000. Good afternoon. It's The Bigger Picture and I'm Mira Sivasodhi. We have Dr. Badrul Hisham Bahazur, who's a consultant urologist from Sunway Medical Center, in the studio answering your questions on urinary stones. We're sort of moving towards surgical management of it. I'm almost afraid to go down that path, Dr. Badrul. But if you have a question, once again, the number to call us is 03-7710-9000. Tweet BFM Radio or text us at BFM Radio. Dr. Badrul, when you talk about surgical management, what are some of the options?
Right. It's interesting that you use the word surgery. And whenever I mention the word surgery, the patient gets taken aback.
Of course.
They think they're going to be opened up, cut open and have a big scar. But that's actually not something that urologists tend to perform anymore. The last time I performed an open surgery to take out a kidney stone was probably about 8 years ago. So nowadays, when we say surgery to treat urinary stones, we are talking about minimally invasive surgery, or the other term would be endoscopic surgery, where there are no more cuts made on the skin. What we try to do is to use the natural orifice, so natural access that the body has, which would be the urethra. Mm-hmm. Or if we need to get into the kidney, for instance, we can just get by creating a small hole the size of maybe a 20 cents coin. So that's what we mean nowadays by doing a surgery. I like to use the term procedure now, just so that the patient doesn't get scared.
But at what stage do you decide this patient needs surgery?
All right, okay. So the treatment will depend on a few factors. First of all, we look at the stone. So we think about the site, size, and we predict what sort of composition it is. And some stones are harder than another one. Yeah. So there's stone factor, and there's also the patient factor. So what sort of symptoms? How bad is the pain, for instance? Has the patient got any complications such as infection or impairment to the kidney function? What sort of comorbidities that the patient has, whether he's got diabetes, hypertension, what sort of medications they are taking. And then we also look at ourselves, at our expertise. Are we comfortable or trained to do a type of procedure, for instance? And what kind of technicalities and instruments available at the place where we are practicing? So we have to look that as a whole, and then we can counsel the patient as to what kind of treatment is suitable for the stone. So, just to simplify it, so I will just divide the stones into the location and the size, actually. So for kidney stones, if the stones are small, we take, say, the size of less than 2 centimeters, we can do blasting, which I think Robert called that, as shockwave lithotripsy.
Yes.
So it's also known as blasting, not laser, but blasting. Or a treatment where a flexible fiber optic camera is inserted from the urinary passage into the kidney, and actual laser energy is now used to fragment the stones into small pieces. If the stone is big in the kidney, what we tend to do nowadays is to create an access on the skin, the size of 20 cents coin, directly into the kidney, where bigger devices, bigger cameras and stone fragmentation devices can be inserted directly into the kidney to break them and remove them immediately. If the stone is located within the ureter, within the tube that connects kidney to the bladder, we tend to try and remove that by putting in an endoscopic camera and breaking it using either laser or pneumatic lithoclast, kind of like a jackhammer that you see on the road.
No. Don't describe that.
Something like that, you know, minuscule. Yeah.
You just switched the word surgery to procedure. Jackhammer just doesn't fit in here.
Or we can use...
Get the picture, I understand.
Okay. Or we can just use the shockwave machine to generate shockwave, focus on the stones and break it. And finally, stones which is located in the bladder can generally be removed again by endoscopic devices, which is inserted again through the natural urinary passage, using again the pneumatic lithoclast or laser again. Some may want to remove that by doing an open surgery in very exceptional cases if the stones are big and many.
Are they really hard, these stones? I mean, are they really, really hard?
Well, they would probably be something like a stone which you get in outside the road.
Really?
Yeah.
That hard?
It's that hard, yeah.
Okay. And when you go in, can you just remove the other stones if you happen to see them?
Yeah, we try to remove all stones because any remaining stones can be a nidus for future stones.
Okay. And usually do you find more stones? I mean, more than one stone?
No, what we have to plan beforehand, and that's the use of the imaging that we did during diagnosis. So we know pretty much how many and where are they located. And using that as a map, that will guide us as to where we need to go, where we need to maneuver our scopes to go and get it out.
Okay. And what will be the most challenging for you when you carry out these procedures?
I guess to convince the patients, first of all, that, you know, despite maybe them not having the symptoms, that they have a big stones, that these stones still need to be taken out. That's probably one of the challenge first. Because once they hear that, you know, you're going to put something into their urinary passage, they will be afraid. Other than that, technicalities, it requires a lot of equipment, especially if one is performing a percutaneous kidney surgery to remove stone, also known as PCNL. It would require accurate targeting to make sure that the hole that is created is created at the right site, at the most ideal site, in order to clear out all the stones.
Okay. Mm. Sometimes I feel open surgery is the best.
Well, you're left with a big scar, and there's more pain, and the patient would have to stay in hospital a lot longer than if the patient were to have a minimally invasive surgery.
What's the success rate?
Well, with endoscopic surgery and percutaneous surgery, the success rate is close to 100%.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's convincing enough.
Yeah.
Okay. We have another question here from Aziruddin. He's asking, is it possible to find calcium excess or deposits in other organs, like the ovary, for an example?
Yeah, that's not unusual. It can occur due to a disease, or it can occur just because of aging. For instance, sometimes a diagnosis can be wrongly made. A calcification can be seen within an X-ray, and those who are not trained may think that that's actually a ureteric stone, but it's actually just a calcified pelvic veins. So calcification can occur as a result of aging. So older women can sometimes have calcified ovaries and calcified areas of their uterine fibroids, for instance. Mm-hmm. So
and calcification happens in the heart as well.
Yes, that's right, in blood vessels. And you know, when we do the scan, sometimes that can fool us into thinking that calcification is a stone, whereas it's actually just atheroma within the blood vessels.
Right. As you said, the gallbladder stone is different and hence it's different. Yeah. And what's the recovery process like for surgery?
Yeah, well, for shockwave lithotripsy, like I mentioned before, the patient doesn't need to stay in hospital. For most endoscopic cases, which doesn't require long procedure, the patient actually can just stay overnight or maybe just a day case again. For percutaneous surgery, they tend to stay anywhere from 3 days to 5 days in hospital. And you normally will have full recovery within a week or two.
Okay, that's pretty good actually. Yeah. We have advanced very much as far as the management of urinary stones is concerned.
Well, we have, yeah. We have largely helped by the advancement of equipment and probably imaging and video systems.
How do you keep yourself abreast? I mean, you weren't taught all of this in medical school, so how did you pick it up? You know, how did you get yourself comfortable with technology?
Well, as any consultant, any specialist, I think you will be going to all these conferences and you know, medical education events to update yourself. And once there is a new technique that is being popularized, one would try and get an attachment, for instance, in those centers and try to educate themselves of this new technique. Mm-hmm. And all actually for the betterment of treatment, and you know, you want to better outcome for the patients.
All the time.
All the time,
all the time. So we're almost running out of time. Would you have a message for the surgical management of urinary stones?
Well, I would say that, first of all, anyone living in this sort of climate, you know, would need to drink lots of water. And by drinking is to produce more urine. And not just concentrating on the amount of that you drink, but concentrate on more of the amount that you actually produce. You know, if you are producing concentrated urine, not much, you need to top it up with more water, okay? So the guide as to, you know, drink 6 or 8 glasses, you know, you probably need to drink a lot more, especially if you're active. That's probably one thing. And it's the cheapest way of preventing urinary stone formation. That's actually proven by science.
Okay, in view of the fasting month that's just coming up in, I think, 2-3 weeks time, would you have advice?
Yeah, it's a tricky issue because you're limited as to the time at which you can drink water. I suppose throughout the night, the person needs to keep it up with
keep
water.
Keep
themselves hydrated. Mm, yeah.
That's going to be hard work, especially when you have to sleep, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then at the same time, you have to go and get some of these
fluid
out of your body. So,
yes, exactly.
Okay, quite a challenge indeed. Yeah. But anyway, thank you very much for joining us today. That was enlightening indeed. That was Dr. Badrul Hisham Bahazur, a consultant urologist from Sunway Medical Center, speaking to us about the surgical management of urinary stones on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.